Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Podcast. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we've got a new arrangement here where the show has become a podcast that's shared on WVIK NPR out of the Quad Cities. And our focus is still on important political, economic, cultural issues in the Heartland region here in the Midwest, but focus on eastern Iowa and western Illinois. My guest today is a candidate for Congress in the Scott County area, eastern Iowa area. It's a second congressional district. It's a seat that's opened up when the existing Congressman Dave Loebsack announced he was not going to run again. And for folks out there that aren't into politics a lot, but just take an interest in it, open seats are usually pretty competitive, and this one is no exception. The Republican candidate is with me today. She's State Senator Marionette Miller Meeks from Iowa's 41st District, which is down along the Missouri border. She's been a guest of mine before. She's got a very interesting background. Somebody who enlisted in the Army at the age of 18 and is a nurse and a physician, retired as a lieutenant colonel. Very impressive background. Senator, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for having us, and I'm glad to see that you've moved to a new forum, if this is something that has been in your plans to do so. But it's wonderful to talk with you.
Yeah. Well, the first topic I want to talk about is, of course, I think the one that's on everybody's minds, and is still this COVID pandemic we face. And, of course, everybody, the national media especially, is focused on Bob Woodward's book that came out called Rage last week. And it kind of pointed a finger at the president for maybe not doing enough at the federal level to prepare the country. What's your thoughts as a candidate for office, as a sitting public official, and as a physician and expert on medical field? Was there more that could have been done at the federal level to prepare the country for this pandemic?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to answer this more as a doctor and a former director of the Department of Public Health. And I think that we should be beyond the finger pointing, beyond the blame, beyond the shame, beyond the cancel culture, and really be working together, all parties, all citizens, to try to get us through this. The reality is that the president stopped travel from China way back in January, was royally criticized for that by the media and by the Democrat Party. People can go look at the videos to see the reactions of the Democrat Party towards the president's travel ban, then a travel ban from Europe, as it became known that there may be a mutation of the virus affecting Europe rather than the same virus that had come from China. And there are trade routes between Iran and China and Italy and China there. So I think there were actions taken early on, all presidents, and when I was director of public health, you don't want to scare the public. You don't want the public to panic. Until we knew more about the virus, I think it was appropriate to shut down travel. It was appropriate to look at closing off the economy, limiting large groups. I think all of those things were appropriate to do. If for people who have never been in business or a part of business, to change your manufacturing from cars to ventilators, or like here in my town, from manufacturing wheelchair parts to face shields, or manufacturing equipment for club foot to face shields, or to gowns, or to gloves, or some of our distilleries to manufacture hand sanitizer. It is not easy to reroute a manufacturing plant to produce something else. And so for that to have occurred within a span of 2 months, I think is really laudatory. And so what I'd like to look at is that this is a virus that we did not know a lot about. We did not get accurate information from China, nor were UN physicians, any public health people, or for that matter with the World Health Organization, allowed to go into China. Hong Kong was concerned about this and was trying to alert the rest of the world that there was human-to-human transmission. So I think early on we just did not have enough information. As we got the information about who was the most vulnerable, who was most affected. So we know age is a factor, obesity, diabetes, And then people of color, and why people of color? Is it because of pre-existing medical conditions? Is it solely poverty? We still don't know that precisely and need to ferret that out. Are there health deficiencies other than age? And then the next biggest risk factor, honestly, is close proximity for a prolonged period of time. And that's been defined as, 12, 15, less than 18 inches for greater than 15 minutes with someone who's infected. So as we know about the virus, we alert people. We have to be transparent about that. But then the other thing is that this virus, unlike influenza, unlike coronavirus, unlike other viruses that we've had to tackle, this virus has proven to be extraordinarily resilient. So remember early on back in, as Italy was being affected, as we were watching what was happening in South Korea, they were checking temperatures. So fever, it was upper respiratory symptoms, fever, cough, cold, sore throat, much like influenza, trouble breathing. Those were felt to be the symptoms that would prompt you to get a test or, to get admitted to the hospital and evaluated for COVID as well as influenza, because we were in influenza season at the time. But then we started having people that had problems with smell or headache. And so there were neurological symptoms, people who ended up having meningitis. And then added to that were people who had upset stomachs and vomiting. So that was a whole new intestinal set of symptoms. And then it was blood clotting. So this is a virus that has proven to mutate, to be very tricky, very resilient. Most viruses do go away when warmer. Influenza goes away. It's a seasonal variation. Yeah, it'll be here in the wintertime, then it'll go south of the equator for their winter. Other coronaviruses that cause the common cold will do the same thing. But this virus has been very resilient, very strange. It has not acted in the way that viruses typically act. So we have to adapt to those circumstances. And I think all of us can do that working together, stopping the blaming and the shaming, and work together on strategies that will go forward. We have a party in a media that is trying to scare people not to get a vaccine. I will tell you, as soon as the vaccine is available, I will get the vaccine. I trust our scientists in this country. University of Pittsburgh has been working on, they had the virus from the original SARS, so they already had some information on vaccine development. They were already working with mRNA. And so when that vaccine is available, I will take that vaccine. I trust our scientists. I trust our FDA to only have a vaccine that is safe, that is proven to be effective. But to have a vaccine developed in an efficient, rapid process because of the way that this virus has acted, I do think it's important that it's developed as rapidly as possible, but safe and effective, and the public will be protected and can be assured that there will be an appropriate vaccine that's available.
We're still suffering, as you know, from the economic effects of this pandemic. In Scott County, I was just looking, the unemployment rate it's down about 5 points from its high in April, but it's still about double what it was before this started. There's currently discussions in Washington going back and forth over another COVID relief package. Do you support another package? And if so, what would it entail?
Well, I think what I want to say is that I'm going to counter a narrative that I've heard often. And it's interesting that this whole pandemic has really created a class divide. And what I mean by that is that people who say it's okay to keep everything shut down, we can work from home. So you have educated people, people in tech, people that can work remotely, and so they can be at home, they can get a paycheck, and they're not at risk. But then you have other individuals, our healthcare people, our first responders, our fire, our police, people that work in the food industry, and often these are people who have minimum wage jobs or low income jobs, but they're essential workers, and they have to go out every single day. So the point I want to make is that we as a nation should reject the narrative that this is life versus the economy. That is patently false. This is life. Everybody has had to make sacrifices through this pandemic. People have suffered. I know of farmers who committed suicide when they had to euthanize their herd. I know of people who have lost their business who called upon me as their state senator to help them to get PPP. I've helped people get their stimulus checks. I've had helped people navigate through unemployment. One individual who didn't have access to the internet, trying to get them their stimulus check and unemployment. Small businesses calling upon you. This has been an extraordinarily serious event to all of us. And what we should do as leaders is not to make people panic, but to give them hope where it is justifiable to give them hope, that all of us have suffered through this. I think what the federal government did when they closed down businesses and asked them to shut down for the benefit of those that were at low risk of contracting and having a serious illness and or death from the virus, they asked us as a nation to do that, and we did that. It was appropriate for the federal government to step in, and I know that increases our deficit. I know it increases our debt, which is a serious issue. But this is a life versus life situation that we're dealing with. I think it was appropriate for the federal government to step in, to provide a stimulus, to provide unemployment, to talk about those industries that are essential industries that we need to keep reopen the economy. Parameters by how we would reopen our economy, what things we should look for, just like with the vaccine. The CDC and President Trump have already put forth a list of who are going to be the first people to get the vaccine, how it will be rolled out. And so I think that was appropriate. I think given that, and you're right, we had our unemployment numbers come out again today with IRA Workforce Development. Our unemployment continues to decrease, but we still have a long way to go. We had basically we didn't have enough people to fill jobs in our state before the pandemic. Governor Branstad and now Ambassador Branstad and Governor Reynolds especially has done a phenomenal job in growing our economy here with the Future Ready Iowa concurrent enrollment and other things. I won't go into all that. But now we need to look at, do we have a fourth stimulus and what does that look like? And I do think of a phase four stimulus package or recovery package, which is how I prefer to call it, I think is appropriate. I think working on an infrastructure bill for those businesses that may never come back, we need to work on an infrastructure bill. It needs to be multi-year. It needs to be broad-based. And we've got bridges, roads, locks and dams on the Mississippi where you are important. And then the other part of our infrastructure that rarely is talked about is broadband. And I passed bills in the state Senate to increase broadband within our state. It is very important. I'm in a rural area. My internet connection is satellite or Wi-Fi. If there's a cloud in the sky, my internet connection can go out. And so when we passed the bill in the state Senate, I lovingly called it, please get Senator Miller makes better internet connection so our children will come and stay home longer. But, and I think the pandemic really underscored structure and that grid to be because we're in a situation in my field in telehealth, telemedicine, and then we had telework, and then we have teleeducation and telelearning. So all of those things have underscored how important getting cable, getting broadband out, using our rural electric co-ops to do that if we can, and other companies that are primed to do that, increasing the amounts of the grants. We actually used some of the COVID-19 recovery money to go, I think that was the plan, is to go into our broadband. So, yes, I think it's appropriate. I think this is one of those places where the federal government has a role in helping states to navigate through this and to get back to full employment.
You're listening to the Heartland Politics Podcast. I'm Robin Johnson. This show airs on WVIK NPR in the Quad Cities. And my guest today is Iowa State Senator Marionette Miller Meeks from the 41st District, who's running as the Republican candidate for Congress in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. It's one of the most closely watched races in the country. We've been talking a little bit about the COVID pandemic and the possibility of another recovery bill. I want to change gears a little bit. You touched on China earlier. And I think one of the things that I was hearing, I haven't read the Woodward book, but one of the things that stood out in the discussions about it was how China's leader lied to President Trump about the extent of this virus early on. This goes to my broader question, Senator, and in how to manage relations with China. I mean, as you know, I don't need to tell you this, but for our listeners, I mean, that's an enormous market for agricultural goods. but also with what China's been doing, building up their military presence in the Pacific, the stealing of our intellectual property, and on and on. You know, it presents a huge challenge to how to manage this relationship. There's an economic side, there's a national security side. How do you think I mean, if you're elected, how would you advise whoever the president is to manage this relationship better, which is so important to our future, not only economically, but for purposes of war and peace?
Yeah, and you actually summarized it extremely well. So we have an economic interest, and we have a national security interest in China. And this is true with other nations as well, but especially China as it has emerged in its growth, in its markets. And so I think most people feel that the Chinese Communist Party should be held accountable for the release of the virus, for the misinformation, for the lack of forthrightness, the lack of allowing people, health professionals into the country to be able to help with the response, for denying that there was human-to-human transmission. Yes, the Chinese Communist Party needs to be held accountable. But how do you do that when they're a trading partner? And in Iowa, our agricultural economy does have a vested interest in having continued trade with China. But I'll also tell you, it was farmers who first told me about China and that they were waiting for a president who would take on China. They felt that trade practices were unfair with China. China was manipulating its currency. I mean, I had been reading that in the Wall Street Journal, but to have a farmer out in Corydon tell me, because people think of farmers in a certain light, in a rather biased viewpoint, but here farmers are telling me they're manipulating their currency, it's unfair trade practices, it hurts us, and anytime we reduce any acreage, it's picked up by South America or other countries, and then we have this unfair. So the trade agreements that both our Secretary of Ag, Mike Naig, and then before him, Secretary Northey, both Governor Reynolds and former Governor Branstad, those trade agreements that they worked extremely hard to get those trade agreements in Asia and in Southeast Asia and with China. And so I think, and then when you look at what happened with intellectual theft, so as a person in the medical profession, we were seeing that. Remember China, Chinese Communist Party kept one of our stealth bombers that had gone down and under the Clinton administration, and a year or two later they returned it to us. And that was so that they could get all of the electronic technology and proprietary information from the stealth bomber. I presume that's why it was done. So those were tremendous issues that in order to gain market share, U.S. companies were willing to allow the theft of intellectual property, and it had to be addressed. And President Trump, quite honestly, was the first president who said we need to equalize the playing field. We need a fair playing field. We need to address the theft of intellectual property. We need to bring manufacturing back to the United States. And so what, in fact, has the pandemic showed us? We need to diversify our supply chain. We cannot continue to allow on the Chinese Communist Party to be the only source of pharmaceuticals, especially antibiotics, to be the only source of PPE. That manufacturing needs to be brought back to the United States. Maybe not all of it, maybe not 100%, but we certainly cannot be reliant, and neither can the world, quite frankly, be reliant upon one country for these life-sustaining equipment and pharmaceuticals. So we know that that needs to be brought back on. So I've had farmers, individuals, I've listened to people, I've talked with businesses. Something needed to be done about China and need to be brought on. But how do we do that now that we have these trade agreements? We had the Phase One China trade agreement that was put forth and passed. How do we hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable, but at the same time continue to have favorable trading relationships and trade partnerships, given everything else that the Chinese Communist Party is doing? And I think the way that you do that is you do that with the international community. We're not the only country who thinks the Chinese Communist Party should be held accountable for the pandemic. We can use our international partners, other countries, and hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable through our international organizations. So through the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, the UN, the International Monetary Fund, we can use other international organizations to hold China accountable, either not elevating people within the organization and or putting U.S. or other Western countries, individuals and expertise at a higher ranking level and more in charge and more at the table. And I think that's how you hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable. Having been stationed in Southeast Asia when I was in Korea, having friends who are Asian, I think talking with them, talking this over, I have not yet had a chance to talk with Ambassador Branstad about this, but I do think that that's an avenue that we can take so that we don't put at risk our trading relationships, our import-exports, but at the same point in time hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable and then take action on moving manufacturing back to the United States and working on manipulation of currency and intellectual property theft.
Senator, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I want to be respectful of your time, but also give you enough time to answer. I've got one question. It's probably a longer answer, a final question, which is just a short answer. But I want to talk health care. You've got a unique perspective on this. Of course, Obamacare has been in place for, around 10 years. Do you feel there's still movement to repeal Obamacare? There's some critical provisions of it, like covering pre-existing conditions, et cetera. That would be up in the air if that was done. What's your view? Would you support repealing it, or do you feel you the best approach is try to work within what's already in law? Or I just wanted to ask you and get your opinion because I don't think I asked about that our first interview.
I've long supported coverage for pre-existing conditions and keeping young individuals on their parents' health care, young adults on their parents' health care policy until they were 27. I've always supported those provisions. But I was also accurate when the bill was put forward and then passed that it would lead to consolidation among the industry, which would lead to decreased competition, that in fact people would lose their doctors, they would lose their health insurance plans, that health insurance would become more expensive. All of that has borne out. Pharmaceuticals are more expensive, health insurance premiums. I was just talking with some businesses recently. Their premiums again went up 21% this year, even though they have not had any major medical issues within their company. And these are small companies that are trying to provide insurance coverage. Some of them have 20 people, some have 50, some have 100 or more. So in talking with businesses, they continue to see this individual lost their insurance and it was too expensive for them to purchase or to get new insurance coverage, but yet they weren't eligible for the expanded Medicaid. Deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses have also gone up. There were some provisions that have been struck down that have been helpful in regards to the Affordable Care Act, but it was fascinating to me that the Affordable Care Act was supposed to be what ended the problems in healthcare, and last summer watching the presidential debates, healthcare again was the main topic. So I'm just going to say very clearly that I have, as a state senator, I have a tremendous track record on patient-friendly, consumer-friendly provisions. So I passed a bill out of the Senate, and it has come law on pharmacy benefit managers. We were trying to get the rebates back, but we got the transparency, and the transparency is hugely important. This is aimed at lowering prescription drug prices. I passed bills on medical switching, non-medical switching, where an insurance company can switch your medication without your doctor's awareness or knowledge or without discussion with your doctor. I passed forward legislation to get access to prenatal care for lawful permanent residents who are pregnant. I passed legislation ending pre-authorization. So I have passed a lot of legislation, not necessarily supported by the insurance industry, but it was the right thing to do for patients, and it was patient-centered policy. So I have long done that. I've been an advocate for that, and I will continue to support healthcare and healthcare reform that is more affordable, that increases access, but very importantly, still allows us to have choice in what we want to have within our healthcare plans. So there are different ways to do that. I'm willing to listen to people, meet with experts, meet with other individuals, on both sides of the aisle so that we can pass forward, not something through one chamber, one party, when they have a supermajority, but that we can pass bipartisan legislation, which is geared to making health insurance affordable, making it accessible, increasing access to health insurance and health care, or medical care, and that still offers an individual choice.
Final question, real quick. If you're elected, what two or three committees would you love to be on, and what would be the first bill that you would have your name on, either as a sponsor or co-sponsor? What would that bill address?
Well, I think, you know, there are certainly committees that you really want to be on, but you want to serve your state and your district.
Sure.
So, you know, where I would be assigned to serve my state and my district, whether it be veterans, agricultural, armed services, ultimately and hopefully in very short order, I would be on energy and commerce, which is where healthcare is. I think the first bill that I would pass is if we are not finished with COVID-19, if we're still battling COVID-19, it would be geared towards increased testing, increased vaccine. So it would be geared towards protecting us and preparing us for the completion of COVID-19, making sure we have enough PPE, that we have redoing our strategic stockpile. Now, if COVID-19 is over, I think the first bill that I want to see passed would be an infrastructure bill. And I think that's because this is such a critical area. We know that there are businesses that have, that have been lost, businesses that are going bankrupt. And so in order to help our economy and our infrastructure and the necessity, as I said, for broadband that has proven to be so necessary during the pandemic, for telehealth, telelearning, and telework, that an infrastructure bill that would help get increased employment, which would help with our deficit, our debt, would help all of our states, a multi-year bill. I think that would be an important bill, and it's something the president has talked about before.
All right. State Senator Marionette Miller-Meeks, the Republican candidate for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, has been our guest today. Senator, as always, thank you very much for taking the time. I know you're very, very busy. I would have loved to have more time to talk. I know you love to talk policy, but we'll save that perhaps for a future occasion.
Absolutely. Would love to be back and discuss with you. So thank you so much, and thank you to your listeners as well, too, for tuning in.